automated and simplified for the sake of efficiency and higher productivity. The great shift from an industrial economy to a knowledge and service economy has improved the immediate working conditions of many, but has locked countless others into low-paying service sector jobs that experience the same alienating disconnection from the fruits or products of their work. And even in many areas such as finance, where workers make far more than sweatshop wages, the size and complexity of global corporations now makes it difficult for even high-ranking executives to understand what their labor is producing. A banker in a small town making mortgage and small business loans can easily see the purpose and fruit of her labor. A bank worker bundling thousands of subprime loans and buying and selling them in enormous blocks of capital will have more difficulty answering the question, "What is your work for?" Work can even isolate us from each other. There was a man, all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. "For whom am I toiling?" he asked, "and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This, too, is meaningless, a miserable business." Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. This man is alone, without friends or family, as a result of his work. Work can convince you that you are working hard for your family and friends while you are being seduced through ambition to neglect them. Work involves depriving, delayed gratification, and sacrifice. But he asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of enjoyment?" In the end, he finds that working for his own sake is unrewarding. Commentator Derek Kidner adds, "This picture of lonely, pointless busyness checks any excessive claim we might wish to make for the blessings of hard work." The danger of choice. Ecclesiastes says, "A person can do nothing better than to find satisfaction in their own toil." Chapter 2, verse 24. One of the reasons so many people find work to be unsatisfying is, ironically, that people today have more power to choose their line of work than did people in the past. Recently, David Brooks wrote in the New York Times about an online discussion conducted by a Stanford professor with students and recent graduates about why so many students from the most exclusive universities go into either finance or consulting. Some defended their pathways. Others complained that the smartest people should be fighting poverty, ending disease, and serving others, not themselves. Brooks said that while the discussion was illuminating, he was struck by the unspoken assumptions. Many of these students seem to have a blinkered view of their options. There's crass but affluent investment banking. There's the poor but noble nonprofit world. And then there is the world of high-tech startups, which magically provides money and coolness simultaneously. But there was little interest in or awareness of the ministry, the military, the academy, government service, or the zillion other sectors. Furthermore, few students showed any interest in working for a company that actually makes products. Community service has become a patch for morality. Many people today have not been given vocabularies to talk about what virtue is, what character consists of, and in which way excellence lies, so they just talk about community service. In whatever field you go into, you will face greed, frustration, and failure. You may find your life challenged by depression, alcoholism, infidelity, your own stupidity, and self-indulgence. Furthermore, around what ultimate purpose should your life revolve? Are you capable of heroic self-sacrifice, or is life just a series of achievement hoops? You can devote your life to community service and be a total schmuck. You can spend your life on Wall Street and be a hero. Understanding heroism and schmuckdom requires fewer Excel spreadsheets, more Dostoevsky and the Book of Job. Brooks's first point is that so many college students do not choose work that actually fits their abilities, talents, and capacities, but rather, choose work that fits within their limited imagination of how they can boost their own self-image. There were only three high-status kinds of jobs, those that paid well, those that directly worked on society's needs, and those that had the cool factor. Because there is no longer an operative consensus on the dignity of all work, still less on the idea that in all work we are the hands and fingers of God, serving the human community, in their minds they had an extremely limited range of career choices. That means lots of young adults are choosing work that doesn't fit them, or fields that are too highly competitive for most people to do well in. And this sets many people up for a sense of dissatisfaction or meaninglessness in their work. Perhaps it is related to the mobility of our urban culture and the resulting disruption of community, but in New York City, many young people see the process of career selection more as the choice of an identity marker than a consideration of gifting and passions to contribute to the world. One young man explained, "I chose management consulting because it is filled with sharp people, the kind of people I want to be around." Another said, "I realized that if I stayed in education, I'd be embarrassed when I got to my 5-year college reunion, so I'm going to law school now." Where one's identity in prior generations might come from being the son of so-and-so, or living in a particular part of town, or being a member of a church or club, today, young people are seeking to define themselves by the status of their work. What wisdom, then, would the Bible give us in choosing our work? First, if we have the luxury of options, we would want to choose work that we could do well. It should fit our gifts and our capacities. To take up work that we can do well is like cultivating ourselves as gardens filled with hidden potential. It is to make the greatest room for the ministry of competence. Second, because the main purpose of work is to serve the world, we would want to choose work that benefits others. We have to ask whether our work or organization or industry makes people better or appeals to the worst aspects of their characters. The answer will not always be black and white. In fact, the answer could differ from person to person. In a volume on the Christian approach to vocation, John Birnbaum and Simon Steer presented the case of Debbie, a woman who made a great deal of money working for an interior decorating company in Aspen, Colorado. The craft of interior design, like architecture or the arts, is a positive way to promote human well-being. But she often found herself using resources in ways that she could not reconcile with pursuing the common good. She left her career to work for a church, and later for a U.S. senator. Debbie said, "Not that there was anything dishonest or illegal involved, but I was being paid on a commission basis, 30% of the gross profit. One client spent $20,000 in the early 1980s on furnishings for a 10-by-12-foot room. I began to question my motivation for encouraging people to spend huge sums of money on furniture. So, I decided to leave." This example is not about the value of the interior design profession or the commission form of compensation. Rather, it illustrates the need for everyone to work out, in clear personal terms, how their work serves the world. Someone else in the same situation might have chosen to stay, to focus on helping clients create beautiful homes, and to see the commissions as a legitimate expression of the value of that beauty. Third, if possible, we do not simply wish to benefit our family, benefit the human community, and benefit ourselves. We also want to benefit our field of work itself. In Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we saw that God not only cultivated his creation, but he created more cultivators. Likewise, our goal should not simply be to do work, but to increase the human race's capacity to cultivate the created world. It is a worthy goal to want to make a contribution to your discipline, if possible, to show a better, deeper, fairer, more skillful, more ennobling way of doing what you do. Dorothy Sayers explores this point in her famous essay, Why Work? She acknowledges that we should work for the common good and for others, as we observed in Chapter 4. But she doesn't want us to stop there. She says that the worker must serve the work. The popular catchphrase of today is that it is everybody's duty to serve the community, but there is in fact a paradox about working to serve the community, and it is this, that to aim directly at serving the community is to falsify the work. There are very good reasons for this. The moment you only think of serving other people, you begin to have a notion that other people owe you something for your pains. You begin to think that you have a claim on the community. You will begin to bargain for reward, to angle for applause, and to harbor a grievance if you are not appreciated. But if your mind is set upon serving the work, then you know you have nothing to look for. The only reward the work can give you is the satisfaction of beholding its perfection. The work takes all and gives nothing but itself, and to serve the work is a labor of pure love. The only true way of serving the community is to be truly in sympathy with the community, to be one self part of the community, and then to serve the work. It is the work that serves the community. The business of the worker is to serve the work. Sayers's point is well taken, and not often made or understood. It is possible to imagine you are serving the community because what you do is popular, at least for a time. However, you may no longer be serving the community. You may be using it for the way its approval makes you feel. But if you do your work so well that by God's grace it helps others who can never thank you, or it helps those who come after you to do it better, then you know you are serving the work and truly loving your neighbor. A handful of quietness. In the midst of Kohelet's gloom regarding the pointlessness of work, a couple of gleams shine through. There is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work, because that is their lot. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 22. Yes, work is our inescapable lot, and so satisfaction in that realm is essential to a satisfactory life. But how do we get that satisfaction in light of all that we have against us? The answer, to find satisfaction in all their toil, this is the gift of God. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 13. How can we secure this? Kohelet provides a hint. Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Kohelet commends, literally, one handful of quietness, by contrast with two alternatives. One is the two handfuls of wealth that come from toil and chasing after the wind, verse 6b. The other is the empty handful of wealth that comes from the idleness of the fool who does not toil at all, verse 5. Kohelet concedes that satisfaction in work in a fallen world is always a miraculous gift of God, and yet we have a responsibility to pursue this gift through a particular balance. Tranquility without toil will not bring us satisfaction, neither will toil without tranquility. There will be both toil and tranquility. How we attain such a balanced life is one of the main themes of Scripture. First, it means recognizing and renouncing our tendency to make idols of money and power. See Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 4. I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Second, it means putting relationships in their proper place. See Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 8. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. Even though it probably means making less money. One handful, rather than two. But most of all, it will mean pursuing something that is beyond the scope of Ecclesiastes to identify. The New Testament reveals that the ultimate source of the tranquility we seek is Jesus Christ, who, because he has toiled for us on the cross, can offer us the true rest for our souls. See Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. Without the gospel of Jesus, we will have to toil not for the joy of serving others, nor the satisfaction of a job well done, but to make a name for ourselves. Chapter 7. Work becomes selfish. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone, and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city, with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." Genesis chapter 11, verses 2, 3, and 4. Making a name for ourselves. One of the reasons work is both fruitless and pointless is the powerful inclination of the human heart to make work, and its attendant benefits, the main basis of one's meaning and identity. When this happens, work is no longer a way to create and bring out the wonders of the created order, as Calvin would say, or to be an instrument of God's providence, serving the basic needs of our neighbor, as Luther would say. Instead, it becomes a way to distinguish myself from my neighbor, to show the world and prove to myself that I'm special. It is a way to accumulate power and security, and to exercise control over my destiny. So often the observation of Kohelet turns true. I saw that all labor and achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This, too, is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 4. Nowhere is the shift from work as grateful stewardship of our gifts to neurotic fabrication of our self-worth more evident than in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. In Genesis chapters 1 and 2, work is a joyful cultivation of creation for its own sake and God's sake. See Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, and chapter 2, verse 15. By Genesis chapter 4, technology has become a means to power. In Genesis chapter 11, we come to the famous story of the building of the Tower of Babel. Two reasons are given for the building of the tower. In verse 3, the people of Shinar say, "Let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly, instead of stone." Someone had discovered a way of making bricks that was an advance beyond previous methods of building. It meant they could build a much taller building than had ever been built before. They wanted to take their new talents and discoveries to use them in a big city. Ever since then, the people with the most creative new ideas continue to seek out cities to find a fertile environment for experimentation and implementation of their dreams. So far, so good. But there is a second, deeper reason for their project of city building, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Verse 4. What were the builders of the tower doing their work for? What are most of today's ambitious workers doing their work for? Verse 4 tells us vividly, and the motivation has not changed from that day to this one. It was to maximize their power, glory, and autonomy. Yet even this boast reveals their radical insecurity. They built the city to make a name for themselves through their accomplishments. But if we lack a name, it means we don't know who we are. To make a name, in the language of the Bible, is to construct an identity for ourselves. We either get our name, our defining essence, security, worth, and uniqueness, from what God has done for us and in us, see Revelation chapter 2, verse 17, or we make a name through what we can do for ourselves. Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner writes, "The elements of the story are timelessly characteristic of the spirit of the world. The project is typically grandiose. Men describe it excitedly to one another as if it were the ultimate achievement. At the same time, they betray their insecurity as they crowd together to preserve their identity and control their fortunes." There seem to be two ways that the people of Babel are getting their identity from their work. First, the grandiose statement, "A tower that reaches to the heavens," suggests that they are assigning spiritual value to their work, that they would be better off getting from God. This leads to materialism, as we allow the fruits of our labor to tell us we are healthy and safe. Second, the desire not to be scattered over the face of the whole earth seems to mean that they also get a name from being gathered into a large group. Part of their sense of power and security comes from the size and wealth of their city. While the first kind of identity-making comes from creating an idol of one's individual talents and accomplishments, the second kind comes from making an idol of one's group. This leads, of course, to snobbery, imperialism, colonialism, and various other forms of racism. In the final scene of this brief story, God comes down in judgment on the city, but observe the form of his punishment. Were it a Hollywood special effects blockbuster, he might send lightning and earthquakes to destroy the settlement. Instead, he confuses their language so that they fall into disunity and scatter. Here we see a principle that runs throughout the Bible. Sin has natural consequences. The desires of the sinful heart create strains in the fabric of the real world that always lead to breakdown. Our pride and need for personal significance necessarily lead to competition, disunity, and strife. So, a life of self-glorification makes unity and love between people impossible. It leaves us with the dreary choice between making the self an idol, which leads to the disunity of individualistic cultures, and making the group to an idol, which leads to the suppression of individual freedom in tribal or collective cultures. The two things we all want so desperately, glory and relationship, can coexist only with God. Babel is a pointed case study of the impossibility of building any collective endeavor, a society, an organization, a movement, that really works unless it is grounded beyond itself, in God. Every other society will have to make an idol out of something that will ultimately disappoint. The family, or the individual self, or national pride, or the accruing of personal wealth, something other than God, will end up being considered the bottom line, the summum bonum, the giver of the name. As Derek Kidner puts it, the half-built city is all too apt a monument to this aspect of man. The people of Shinar wanted to build the tallest building in the world. This peculiar project of humankind has shown no signs of abatement for many millennia, and it seems that every year we hear of a building going up somewhere that will make a name for someone new and stand as the world's tallest for a time. This is a vivid example of the spirit of competitive pride that drives the work in every field. Of course, there is something very useful in this dynamic. It stimulates helpful innovation and efficiencies, but there is also something pernicious in it. C.L.C.S. Lewis puts it in Mere Christianity. Now, what I want you to get clear is that pride is essentially competitive, is competitive by its very nature. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say people are proud of being rich, or clever, or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer, or cleverer, or better looking than others. Lewis shows us that we can either build a better mousetrap, taller building, faster computer, cheaper airline, more luxurious hotel, out of interest in excellence and service to human beings, or we can do so in a race to move our organization and ourselves into a position to look down on others. The latter leads to ethical shortcuts and the oppression of those who get in our way. I want to make clear at this point that no one can live entirely out of the pure impulse to serve the interests of other people at all times. Even the most loving, morally beautiful people fall prey to motives of self-interest, fear, and glory-seeking. Our acceptance of our own brokenness and the world's keeps us going back to God to remember what we cannot do on our own. As a matter of fact, It is very dangerous to think of certain people as being the good ones, who work to serve, and of others as the bad ones, who are seeking to prove and serve themselves. The DNA of self-centeredness and competitive pride are at work deep in each of us. The Power of Being in the Palace. An extended case study on the themes of self-interest, power, and vocation can be found in the Old Testament book of Esther. The book recounts an incident when the Jews were dispersed throughout the Persian Empire. In the first chapter, we are told how the Persian emperor, King Xerxes, has disposed of his queen, Vashti, because she was too bold and displeased him. He looks for another queen and discovers Esther, a beautiful young Jewish girl. He sleeps with her, and she pleases him. Esther hides her Jewish identity as she is elevated to be his queen in the royal palace. Almost all readers of this story are offended by this early part of the book of Esther. Feminist interpreters are outraged at Esther's subservience. Others are offended by the fact that, unlike Daniel, who identified himself as a Jew and lived as one publicly in a pagan court, Esther keeps quiet. People of traditional moral views are bothered that she sleeps with a man to whom she is not married. Through all these moral compromises, she rises to a place near the center of power. So we are posed with a question. In such morally, culturally, and spiritually ambiguous situations, does God still work with us and through us? The answer of the book is yes. At the beginning of the fourth chapter of the book of Esther, at the start of Act 2, in a sense, we learn that Haman, a high official, has convinced the king that the Jews are a danger to the empire and has secured a royal decree that on a future date, neighbors of Jewish families throughout the realm will be free to kill them and plunder their wealth. See Esther chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. Esther's relative, Mordecai, a Jewish leader, contacts Esther and tells her she must use her place in the palace to avert this danger. This is a huge request. Here, a believer in God, whose place of power in the public sphere is tenuous, is being called to use her personal and cultural capital to bring about a more just social order. "Who knows," Mordecai says to her, "but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" Esther chapter 4, verse 14. The book of Esther parallels the biblical accounts of Daniel and Joseph. All three people were believers in the God of Israel. Each was an official in a pluralistic, non-believing government and culture. None were prophets, priests, elders, or teachers. They had reached the highest circles of power in their secular cultural institutions, and God used them mightily. Dick Lucas, an English Anglican preacher, once preached a sermon on the story of Joseph. What he said fits in well with this account of Esther. He said that if you were to go to a book table at a church and see a biography with the title, "The Man God Uses," or "The Woman God Uses," you would immediately think it was the story of a missionary, teacher, church leader, or specialist in some sort of spiritual work. He points out that what you have in the story of Joseph is a highly successful secular official. Lucas says, "In the long term, I think being a preacher, missionary, or leading a Bible study group, in many ways, is easier. There is a certain spiritual glamour in doing it, and what we should be doing each day is easier to discern more black and white, not so gray. It is often hard to get Christians to see that God is willing not just to use men and women in ministry, but in law, in medicine, in business, in the arts. This is the great shortfall today." We have a perfect example in this story. Since Jerusalem was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the Jews have been in exile. At this point in biblical history, they are on their way back. They are trying to rebuild their lives, their city, and their nation. Ray Bakke, an academic and writer, points out that God shows the diversity of the people he uses by giving us three different books in the Bible describing how he restores the nation of Israel back to its homeland. First, the book of Ezra is about a minister, a teacher of the word. The Jews needed to be reacquainted with the Bible so their lives could be shaped by what God said. Second, the book of Nehemiah is about an urban planner and developer who used his management skills to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and reinstate stability so that economic and civic life could begin to flourish again. Last, the book of Esther is about a woman with power in the civil government working against racial injustice. Here you have male and female, lay and clergy. You have people working for spiritual maturity, economic flourishing, and better public policy in cultures that defined and valued these ideas differently from the Jews. And God is using them all. Don't be too quick to miss the connection between Esther and us. I remember some years ago hearing a Hispanic preacher preaching on the book of Esther. Many of his older church members had been immigrants and had little money or clout. But many of the younger generation had gone to college and had become professionals. The preacher told them that even though they didn't see it, they were in the palace. They had more financial and cultural capital than they realized. And, he said in no uncertain terms, many of them were using that capital to feather their own nests and move ahead in their own careers rather than leveraging it for others. He reminded them that there were poorer people across the city who needed their connections and talents. He said that inside their circles of influence and fields of work, there was corruption that needed their attention. He admitted that if his listeners conducted themselves in that way, they might make less money or move up the ladder slower or run into conflict that could hurt their careers. But that doesn't matter, he said. Don't just get into the palace and bend every rule you can to stay there. Serve. You have come to your royal position for such a time as this. I know some of us feel like Esther. There is the VP of an investment bank who has kept many of his investors in the dark, maybe only passively. There is the football coach who violates a number of NCAA recruiting rules. There is the municipal official who doesn't take bribes but looks the other way when she sees colleagues who do. In part because of these compromises, they have all risen and now occupy high positions, but their consciences are not clear. You may be like them, on a smaller or larger scale. You may have made some choices that were unethical or very much in the gray area. You may have been asked to repeatedly tell clients that the work was done in a certain way when you knew it wasn't. You may not have spoken out when you knew you should have. You have some clout now, but you don't feel as though your conscience is clear. Do you think Esther's conscience was clear? Is anyone's ever completely clear? It is never too late. God urges you to think about where you are and why you are there, to realize the importance of being in the palace. It's possible that only then can He use you to do His work in this world. I have a friend who worked in private equity at a major financial services firm. We asked him to teach a class on character and integrity in our church. During the class, he shared a recent dilemma in which the team who worked for him identified an excellent investment opportunity that would provide a good return for his team and the company. The only problem was that the business, in my friend's mind, not only didn't make a positive contribution to society, but damaged it. It wasn't illegal, and the firm itself had no issue with investing in the business. He was torn between his obligation to create the highest value for his own company and staff, and his faith-based commitment to human flourishing. He could veto the investment, but that would only put the deal in the hands of a competing bank. He could agree to the investment and profit from something that he didn't believe in. He wanted to at least take a stand and live out his convictions in some way. So he announced to his team that he would not veto the deal, but he would personally choose to not participate in any bonus that might result from their investment. That gave him the opportunity to explain his rationale and present a picture of God's intentions for human flourishing. The deal closed. The investment made the bank a lot of money. But what of my friend's sacrifice? He took an opportunity, at a time cost to himself, to take a stand and point his colleagues to an archaic vision of life in the palace. The peril of being in the palace. Esther's concern was very real. Mordecai was asking her to take an enormous risk. In that time and place, to fall out of favor with the king did not mean losing your job. It more often meant losing your life. Esther replies to Mordecai that it was a capital offense for anyone to go in to the king unbidden, unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Esther chapter 4, verse 11. Surely, Esther is remembering that the last queen was deposed because she was too bold. Mordecai doesn't know what he is asking of her. She could lose everything. Mordecai responds that indeed he does know. He steps up to the high point of the story rhetorically, narratively, and theologically. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Mordecai is saying that if Esther risks losing the palace, she might lose everything, but if she doesn't risk losing the palace, she will lose everything. It is an agonizing argument. If all the Jews are killed, Esther will be sniffed out and killed. If the Jews are not killed, Esther will be considered a traitor. Mordecai then closes with hope. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? Verse 14. What Mordecai says has direct application for most of us. Mordecai, in effect, appeals to the idea of vocation. He says the same thing the Hispanic pastor said. Unless you use your clout, your credentials, and your money in service to the people outside the palace is a prison. It has already given you your name. You may think you have been given little because you are always striving for more, but you have been given much, and God has called you to put it into play. It is natural to root your identity in your position in the palace, to rest your security in the fact that you have a certain measure of control over the variables in your life, to find your significance in having clout in certain circles. But if you are unwilling to risk your place in the palace for your neighbors, the palace owns you. How do you get a new name based on something other than the palace? The text hints at the answer. Grace. Mordecai says to Esther, "Who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this?" The Hebrew word translated as come is a passive verb. It would be better translated, "Who knows but that you were not brought to your royal position because of this?" He is reminding Esther that she did not get to the palace except by grace. She did not develop or earn her beauty, nor did she produce this opportunity. They were given to her. Have you contemplated how much this is true of you too? If someone claims that your professional status is a result of grace, you immediately think they don't know how hard you worked to get into your school, how hard you worked in school and at your internships, how you have performed better than your peers at work, and so on. However, you worked with talents you did not earn. They were given to you. You went through doors of opportunity you did not produce. They just opened for you. Therefore, everything you have is a matter of grace, and so you have the freedom to serve the world through your influence, just as you can through your competence. Living with greatness in the palace. Esther begins to respond. The Esther we know from chapters 1 and 2, the demure beauty queen who lies about her race to stay on the inside track, begins to fade away. The Esther who never rocks the boat and never ruffles any feathers starts to give orders. She sends a message to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Esther chapter 4, verse 16. What happens next is one of the most absorbing narrative accounts in the Bible. By a series of coincidences, of course they are anything but, as well as Esther's own courage, she is received by the king and is able to unmask the hatred and calculation of Haman, so that Haman is executed and the Jewish people saved. But it would be a mistake to end the account here. There is a danger that you might merely be inspired by Esther's example. You look at Esther and decide you are not going to look at your position and your intellectual, social, and financial capital in a new way. Instead of looking at your influence as a means to move yourself ahead, you are going to use it to serve people. You are going to take more risk to see that justice is done. Or you may decide that you have been too quiet about your beliefs, so you resolve to speak up and let people know what you believe. Those are good and right impulses. By all means, follow them. Yet they aren't enough. To begin with, your resolve won't last. If you are merely inspired by an example, you want to be like Esther, or you want to be more like the people the Hispanic pastor said we needed, then your basic motivation is probably guilt. It could be guilt over selfishness, guilt over elitism, even guilt over ungratefulness. And those may be the right place to start. But if guilt is the extent of your motivation, you can be sure it will wear off before long, because living in a new way will be hard. Or you might get inspired, but overreact. So often I have seen people who have previously kept secret about their faith and who overcompensate and become obnoxious. They decide to be an outspoken, principled person. They will not be like those closeted Christians. Yet they haven't really left the palace, because they are still getting their identity from their performance of a better kind of Christianity. They have not really changed. They are very self-righteously being more overt. Let me suggest how you are more likely to live with integrity, even greatness, in the palace. Look at Esther not merely as an example, but as a signpost, a pointer. You see, God created us. He gave us everything we have, and He sustains our life every moment. Therefore, we owe Him everything. But we do not live that way. We live as if everything we have is ours, to use as we see fit, to make our own name. Even people who do not consider themselves Christians know, on reflection, that something is wrong with this picture. By everyone's standards, we are violating our relationship with God. The religions of the world disagree on the story and the reasons, but they all agree on something. There is a gap, or a chasm, between the divine and us. Some religions say we must cross that divide through sacrifice, rituals, transformation of consciousness, or ethical practice. But somehow we need something to bridge that gap between God and ourselves. How will we find it? Here's the answer of the Bible, right from this story. Esther saved her people through identification and mediation. Her people were condemned, but she identified with them and came under that condemnation. She risked her life and said, "If I perish, I perish." Because she identified, she could mediate before the throne of power as no one else could. And because she received favor there, that favor was transferred to her people. Saving people through identification and mediation. Does that remind you of anyone? Jesus Christ, the Son of God, lived in the ultimate palace with ultimate beauty and glory, and He voluntarily left them behind. Philippians chapter 2 says that He had equality with the Father, but He did not hold on to it. Instead, He emptied Himself, identified with us, and took on our condemnation. He did not do it at the risk of his life, but at the cost of his life. He didn't say, "If I perish, I perish," but, "When I perish, I'll perish." He went to the cross and died. He made atonement for our sins. Now he stands before the throne of the universe, and the favor he has procured is ours if we believe in him. He is ultimate mediation. If you see Esther not as an example but as a pointer to Jesus, and if you see Jesus not as an example but as a Savior doing these things for you personally, then you will see how valuable you are to him. Meditate on these things, and the truth will change your identity. It will convince you of your real, inestimable value. And ironically, when you see how much you are loved, your work will become far less selfish. Suddenly, all the other things in your work life, your influence, your resume, and the benefits they bring you, become just things. You can risk them, spend them, and even lose them. You are free. Esther was able to do what she did merely on the basis of a vague revelation that God is a God of grace. But now we know so much more. She didn't know God was actually going to come to earth himself and do what she was doing on an infinitely greater scale, at an infinitely greater cost, with infinitely greater benefits to humanity. We now know so much more about his grace, our value to him, and our future. If you see what Jesus Christ has done for you, losing the ultimate palace for you, then you will be able to start to serve God and your neighbor from your place in the palace. Karen Jobes, who wrote a commentary on the book of Esther, says Esther is called Queen Esther 14 times. 13 of those happen after she says, "If I perish, I perish." She becomes a person of greatness not by trying to make a name for herself. And you will become a person of greatness not by trying to make yourself into one, but by serving the one who said to his father, "For your sake, thy will be done." Chapter 8. Work reveals our idols. Do not make any idols. Exodus chapter 34, verse 17. The pervasiveness and power of idols. David closeted himself in his corner office while his new board of directors considered his demands. "I'll make them come to me," he thought, leaning on the negotiating techniques he had learned over the course of a very successful career. In 2 decades, David had risen to become CEO of a series of increasingly high-profile technology companies, and the previous week had been one of those great moments of payoff. Flying high at dinner after the analyst call announcing the sale of his latest company to a nationally known enterprise, he said to his associate, "This is it. It doesn't get any better than this. This is what it's all about." But now it was time to exit and move on to the next opportunity. While the payoff from this deal was respectable, a valuation of 3 times annual earnings and a nice round $1 million in his pocket, it was really only a stepping stone to a bigger venture. He'd done what he was brought in to do: sell the company before the technology was displaced by another one and give the investors a good return on their dollar. His thoughts floated to the $1 million. His wife wanted a beach house. He wanted a lake house. Their exquisite home had just been renovated, and the kids were doing well. They'd also been able to buy homes for each of their parents, nearby and in good neighborhoods. David felt good about the way he'd been able to support his family. This was important to him. Years ago, as his father struggled with work and money for the family was extremely tight, he'd vowed to himself that his life would be different. He'd used the opportunities his parents had given him, modest as they might be, to make something of himself. It would be a way to honor his father, now passed away, and his children would never have to want for anything. Yet his mom was already saying, "So, David, you have enough already. Do you really have to find the next bigger and better company? What's behind all this drive?" At that point, the door opened, and the board member he'd worked with most closely on the deal walked in. Sitting down, he said, "David, we really need you to honor your contract and stay the full year. The company needs you to lead it right now. You were one of the key reasons we thought buying the company was a good deal. You're smart, you're a good leader, you can negotiate partnerships and deals to keep this company out front. We can't agree to letting you out now." David loathed the prospect of staying on for another year, and was determined to get the full payout in spite of the terms of the contract. He held the ultimate card. They certainly wouldn't want to keep him if he made it clear that he didn't want to stay. No one can lead well if his heart isn't in it, right? A week later, having refused to budge on any point, he walked away with the payout and very quickly moved into the corner office of a Fortune 500 company. When contemporary people hear the word idols, they are most likely to think of the entertainment world, where celebrities are called teen idols, or where aspirants compete to be the next American Idol. Or perhaps the word conjures thoughts of primitive people bowing down to figurines and images. If the word is ever connected to the world of work, it is usually a rhetorical device to say someone has become a workaholic or is rapaciously greedy, so that success or money has become an object of extreme devotion. These are all legitimate uses of the term, but they are only the most extreme cases of the powerful and pervasive conception that is at the heart of biblical faith. The most famous and influential moral code in the world, the Ten Commandments, begins with God's great directive on idolatry. "You shall have no other gods before me." Exodus chapter 20, verse 3. What does it mean to have other gods? The commandment says, "You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 and 5. We have an alternate or counterfeit God if we take anything in creation and begin to bow down to it. That is, to love, serve, and derive meaning from it more than from the true God. Because we can set up idols in our hearts, see Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 3 through 7, we recognize that making an image of something is not necessarily a physical process, but is certainly a spiritual and psychological one. It means imagining and trusting anything to deliver the control, security, significance, satisfaction, and beauty that only the real God can give. It means turning a good thing into an ultimate thing. Many have recognized the significance of the Bible's command against idolatry, placed at the very beginning of God's directions for life. No one grasped its power more than Martin Luther. He defined idolatry as looking to some created thing to give you what only God can give you. Therefore, he argued, even non-religious people serve gods, ideologies or abilities that they believe can justify their lives. French philosopher Luc Ferry, himself a non-believer in God, likewise argues that everyone seeks some way to face life with confidence and death without fear and regret. All of us look to something to assure ourselves we have spent our lives well. David, in our opening example, may have sought financial security, money, and success as his salvation from the struggle of his childhood, although he would never have used that term. Whatever it is we seek, Ferret says, it is a form of salvation. This fits with the implication of the first of the Ten Commandments. God says, "I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me." Notice that God says that either he will be our God or something else will. He leaves open no in-between possibility of having no gods at all that we rely on to save us. Luther saw how harmoniously the concept of idolatry tied the Old and New Testaments together. The Old Testament talks about idolatry a great deal, while the New Testament, especially the letters of Paul, speaks about union with Christ and justification by faith, means through which we are saved by God's grace, rather than by our own efforts. Luther came to realize that these two ideas, to set up an idol and to try to save yourself through your own efforts, are describing essentially the same thing. In his Treatise Concerning Good Works, Luther wrote, "The first commandment commands, 'Thou shalt have no other gods,' which means, since I alone am God, thou shalt place all thy confidence, trust, and faith on me alone, and on no one else. All those who do not, at all times trust God, and his favor, grace, and goodwill, but seek his favor in other things or in themselves, do not keep this commandment, and practice real idolatry. If we do not believe that God is gracious to us and is pleased with us, or if we presumptuously expect to please him only through and after our works, then it is all pure deception, outwardly honoring God, but inwardly setting up self as a false god." Here, Luther argues that when we fail to believe that God accepts us fully in Christ and look to some other way to justify or prove ourselves, we commit idolatry. Secular people may look for favor, grace, and goodwill in the acquisition of power or the experience of pleasure, while religious people may trust in their moral virtue or acts of devotion or ministry. But all are fundamentally the same inner transaction. In each case, the heart is given to a counterfeit god. When Paul walked around Athens, he saw that the city was full of idols. See Acts chapter 17, verse 16. He was speaking of actual physical objects, but once we grasp the biblical definition of idolatry, we realize that every city, and indeed every human heart, is filled with idols. They are literally everywhere. Idols are not only pervasive, they are powerful. Why do the Ten Commandments begin with the prohibition of idolatry? It is, Luther argued, because we never break the other commandments without breaking the first. For example, suppose you know that complete transparency in a business negotiation will yield you considerably less leverage than will a small measure of deceit. In that situation, if you lie or obscure inconvenient facts, it is because you have counted success as more important than obedience to God or the good of your neighbor with whom you are negotiating. So beneath the sin of lying is the deeper conditioning sin of idolatry. It could be argued that everything we do wrong, every cruel action, dishonest word, broken promise, self-centered attitude, stems from a conviction deep in our souls that there is something more crucial to our happiness and meaning than the love of God. Idolatry has power over our actions because it has power over our hearts. 22-year-old Andrew is out of work and broke because he's terrified that if he takes a job loading boxes in a warehouse, he will be stunted for life, earning minimum wage, doing work that only people beneath him do, losing his status among his friends as a cool guy, and perhaps even losing his girlfriend. He had wanted to play baseball, and he nurses that hope, thinking if he could get back into college by playing baseball, then his life would be set. When we set our hope on an idol in this way, we are saying to ourselves, if I had that, it would fix everything. Then I'd feel my life really had value. Now, if anything is our salvation, we must have it, and so we treat it as non-negotiable. If circumstances threaten to take it away, we are paralyzed with uncontrollable fear. If something or someone has taken it away, we burn with anger and struggle with a sense of despair. Cultural and corporate idols. Thus far we have been speaking of individual idols that distort our personal lives. We know that people develop fatal attractions for status and power, for approval and achievement, for romance and sexual pleasure, or for affluence and comfort. Personal idols profoundly drive and shape our behavior, including our work. Idols of comfort and pleasure can make it impossible for a person to work as hard as is necessary to have a faithful and fruitful career. Idols of power and approval, on the other hand, can lead us to overwork or to be ruthless